Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. My wife swears that the boy I've raised just like a son is, in fact, my son. Somehow, though, the lad has come to care deeply about the winnings and losings of professional sports teams. This he did not get from me. From grades 7 through 12, I played a trombone in our high school marching band. So I attended every high school football game for 6 years. During that time, I failed to develop any interest in football, and I never learned the rudiments of the game. Last night, my wife explained to me what a field goal is. I still have no idea what a touchback is. I think both of them add some points to your score, but don't ask me how many. But I loved playing in the band, marching band, and later swing band, and show bands for the Broadway musicals that the senior class performed every year. It struck me then, and now, that American society would be different indeed, better, if we scrapped the damn sports metaphors we use for everything, and instead drew our metaphors from band or orchestra. Here you're not classified into winners and losers. Unlike sports, the trombones are not competing against the clarinets. The trombones don't win by making the French horns lose. The essential interaction is not competition, but cooperation. This being capitalist competitive America, some pervert will always organize a competition among bands. The battle of the bands, or whatever. But this is a perversion of music, and it feels like a perversion when you're forced into a contest like this. It's the antithesis of a musical ensemble. How about competitive Amish barn raising? This week, the Intercourse Pennsylvania Shoeflies versus the Amana, Iowa Cornhuskers. Which brings us to educational psychologist Alfie Cohn. Cohn reviewed the scientific literature, and he does not conclude from it that too much competition is bad. He concludes from it that all competition is bad. Bad for the individual, bad for society. It does not even produce superior practical results. Cooperation does. Of course, celebrating competition is just what you'd expect in a predatory dog-eat-dog economic system. It's what you'd expect in a pyramid-shaped social structure, with a few rich, powerful people at the top, and a huge majority of the less fortunate underneath. It's also good for military recruitment. Do you want to beat those towheads, or do you want to sit around and sip tea with them, you liberal wimp? But let's hear it from Alfie Cohn. This old recording just surfaced. It appears to be from the late 1980s, I'd say 1989. And I'm the first to put it on the air. I win! Take that, David Barsamian! I'm number one! Oops! Here's Alfie Cohn on why competition is a really bad idea.
So cooperative conflict and wrestling with ideas, I think, is fine. But there's a particular kind of conflict, as I've mentioned, that I think is especially disturbing, and that is competition. Basically, there are two respectable positions to take on competition in this country. One is unqualified endorsement, and the other is qualified endorsement. Unqualified endorsement is the Vince Lombardi quote, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there." Or perhaps, given how early it starts now with preschool, we should say a doggy-eat-doggy world out there. And we've got to get kids primed for as much canine consumption as possible very early. If you can't stand the heat, etc., it's good for us, and so on. The second position, the only other one, is one that says something like, competition has gone too far in this country. We push kids too fast and too hard to be number one. But if we keep things in perspective and don't get carried away, then competition can be natural and appropriate and healthy and so on. That used to be my position. But in writing No Contest, I went through more than 400 studies, and slowly I came to a third camp, which may be occupied only by me at this point. And that is as follows. that competition is not destructive or counterproductive in its excess. It is not destructive because we're doing it the wrong way. It is destructive by its very nature. The very phrase, healthy competition, it seems to me, and I think there are good, though largely unknown, data to support this, the phrase healthy competition is a contradiction in terms. And the ideal amount of competition, note I do not say conflict, the ideal amount of competition in any environment, the classroom, the workplace, the family, the playing field, is none. Now, I don't expect that most of you will agree with this. I didn't myself. But I want you to open to the possibility that all things that are bad in excess are not necessarily good in moderation. That's a surprising concept. I like to say to audiences who challenge me on this, you know, hey, well, you know, you don't want to be so radical about it. We need some competition. I say, you know, I agree with you. I think the same thing is true about torturing children. We don't want to overdo it, but you can't have none at all now, can you? The point is that not everything is good in a middle ground. We love this sort of reflexive position of let's not overdo it, but we need some. Some things are inherently destructive. This position has not won me plaudits all over the country, as you can imagine. I'm alternately called a communist and a wimp as I discuss these things. Although never both. Never. I guess you don't need to be spending $300 billion on the Pentagon if the communists, well, you see what I mean. But it's one or the other. But the position is one that I think is backed by research, even though it sounds radical. The idea is that competition, no matter what amount it exists in, is always to that extent destructive. Some competitions are worse than others. Let me define my terms in good social science fashion here. I like to distinguish between what I call structural and intentional competition. By structural competition, I mean what I call mutually exclusive goal attainment, which is a fancy social science expression for I succeed only if you fail. There is a stronger version of this in which I succeed only if I make you fail. You see the difference? In the first case, maybe talking about golf or bowling, I do something, you do something, I do something, you do something. And at the end, of course, we're Americans, we have to have a winner, we compare scores. But we don't interfere with each other's performance. In the stronger version, I succeed only if I make you fail, here we find it in war or tennis. In which, in order for me to do well, I have to actively interfere with how you do it. So a good shot in tennis, for example, is one that you cannot return. That's true by definition. The goal, the objective of the activity is not merely to succeed at the end, but at each moment to interfere with your success. That doesn't mean all tennis players are nasty or neurotic or malicious. It means that the rules of the game, the structure, so to speak, require us to succeed at the expense of other people's failure. And that is what I am arguing is always and by its nature unnecessary and destructive. And I distinguish that structural competition from intentional competition, by which I mean simply the need for one person to be number one. Here we're talking not about the rules of the game, but about the personality. And why I think it's interesting to distinguish between the two is simply that we can have one without the other, and it helps us to clarify matters. Can we have intentional competition without structural? You bet. Some people may have come in here today with their objective being to be ask the cleverest question, or to be the best dressed, or something of that sort, be the funniest. Nobody else is trying for that. There are no trophies being given out. Everyone else just thought they were coming to a lecture. You know, they didn't realize it was a competition as it is for that individual. But even worse, you can have the reverse situation. I think it's worse. Structural competition without intentional. This is something we see every day in this culture. Individuals who are satisfied with simply doing their best, having fun, reaching excellence, but have to do that, have to engage in those goals in a way that prevents other people from reaching theirs. Success and victory, which are two completely different ideas, have been confused, confounded in this society, so we can't understand what it is to do one, to reach one without reaching the other. We have to tease these apart. I'm all in favor of success and excellence, as I am conflict in certain situations. The question is, do we have to do it to the exclusion of other people? I think the answer to that is clearly no. And in my book, I go through the four central myths of competition, which I will summarize very quickly now because I want to move on to the work that I'm doing since that book has come out. Let me deal with three consequences of competition and what has driven me to this surprising view that it's not merely bad in excess. First, there's the question of productivity, or excellence, success. This was the trickiest one. To be very honest with you, when I began this project, I already accepted that competition wasn't very good for us psychologically or for our relationships with each other. But I bought the party line that you needed some competition in order to push yourself to do your best. That there was some dialectical relationship between the two, and we couldn't dispense with that competition without there being a trade-off. Maybe it was worth it. Well, I was wrong. After going through hundreds of studies in the classroom and the workplace, I have become convinced of what I will put into one bald and startling proposition. Not only is competition not required for excellence, its absence is required for excellence. Now, most of these studies, all of these studies really, are available in any good library, but they don't get read and they certainly don't get talked about in the public arena or mentioned in popular publications for the most part. We are brought up not only to compete frantically, but to believe in competition, and it is awfully threatening to have people come along and say, you have been deluded. You are barking up the wrong tree. This is not what leads people to do their best. The Johnsons, David and his brother Roger, have done themselves scores of studies in the classroom. Others have been done by people like Bob Slavin at Johns Hopkins University and many others who have shown repeatedly that cooperation predicts to learning. I'm talking bottom line, hardcore success for children and adults whenever there's learning involved. Cooperation predicts to that more than does competition or individualized attainment. It's true in rural, urban, and suburban schools. It's true for all ages. It's true for all subject matters. The only place they found some variation is that the more complicated the task is, the worse competition does. The more cognitive problem solving and creativity is required, the worse competition stacks up when measured against cooperative approaches. This sort of thing has been found in the workplace too, both in terms of structural and intentional. There have been studies structurally suggesting that people in cooperative workplaces, real-world situations, not some contrived laboratory setup, do better when they're working together than when they're trying to best each other. As well, there have been studies from the University of Texas showing that personal need to compete, what I call intentional competition, gets in the way of success. I don't want to bore you with all these studies now. They're in my book, and others have come out since my book. But the point is that this counterintuitive for us Americans finding has been borne out again and again, even when researchers expected to find the reverse. And one after another, you see them saying, counter to hypothesis. Why? I think there are three reasons. The first, and I'm oversimplifying here because of the limited time available to me, and also because sometimes I get a kick out of oversimplifying. First, competition causes anxiety. When you are trying to beat someone and they're trying to beat you, you are distracted from doing the best job you possibly can because you're afraid someone else is going to step on your face. Not because they're mean, but because that's what competition by nature requires. Second, cooperation allows people to share their talents and their skills and their resources in a way that competition never does. This organization was founded by an astronaut. I've always asked, oh yeah, you think we would have gotten to the moon that fast if we weren't in a race against the Russians? Well, assuming that is a good goal, by the way, a question that is almost never asked when you're in a race, but assuming it is a good goal, I think we would have gotten there an awful lot faster had we been cooperating with the Russians, because competition, among its other faults, is redundant, it's wasteful, it's duplicative. They're solving problems we've already solved, and vice versa. Only when you're able to share can you get there faster and more efficiently. You could share in a competition, but you'd be nuts. It's irrational. Why should I help you if your success comes at the expense of mine? You can't do it in a competitive situation. And that's the other reason why competition is so unproductive, so inefficient, because it doesn't allow for that. And the third reason is, in a way, the simplest and the most subtle at the same time. Not only is the idea of success or excellence completely different from victory or beating other people, not only are they conceptually different, but in actual life, they pull in opposite directions. the more I'm focused on getting that reward of being number one, the less I am concerned about what the task itself has to offer. You remember this kid in school? Ooh, 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 waving her hand wildly. Ooh, the teacher finally calls on her. What was the question again? Why? Because she's not thinking about the subject matter. She's thinking about being number one. And those often are mutually exclusive in practice, the way they feel, as in addition to the way the concepts are in themselves. Now, competition in this respect shares something destructive with all external or extrinsic rewards, whether it's not just the trophy, but grades or money. The more we think of ourselves as working for that goal, the less are we concerned about the intrinsic motivation, what's there in the task itself. Not only are external rewards such as competition less effective as motivators, but in fact they undermine intrinsic motivation. So that people who used to find something very interesting in its own right, once they start doing it in a competitive fashion or for money, you take away that money or the competition and they suddenly lost interest in it. There's a whole literature in the social psychology on this, and it is very powerful in contradicting the ways parents and teachers and managers have been leading their organizations or their homes. People have been systematically undermining curiosity, the single most important predictor to success, in the hope, in the process of trying to help it along. Let me tell you a quick little anecdote that illustrates that. There once was an old man who was taunted by the neighborhood school children. After they came out of school, they would walk onto his lawn and yell, "Hey, you stupid old bald-headed ugly," you know, and so on. And he got tired of this pretty fast. So he came up with a plan. He said, "If you kids come back tomorrow and yell those things at me, I'll pay each of you a dollar." Well, they thought that was pretty good. They hadn't expected it. So they came back even earlier the next day. And they yelled even louder about how ugly and stupid he was. And he said, "Thank you, here's your dollar, here's your dollar, here's your dollar, here's your dollar. If you come back tomorrow, kids, I can pay each of you a quarter." Well, they thought that was still pretty good. So they came back the next day and yelled even more loudly about how stupid and ugly he was. And he paid each of them a quarter. And he said, "Thank you, if you come back tomorrow, I can only pay each of you a penny." They said, "A penny? Forget it." And they never came back again. You see the serious point here? He bought off their intrinsic motivation, and that's exactly what competition does. That's the whole idea. That's what he was trying to do, but it's not what teachers and managers are trying to do, and it's exactly what they're doing anyway. Those are the three reasons I think the research shows with surprising uniformity that competition does not predict a success. But competition is destructive in another respect, and this one I think requires less evidence, and that is that competition does not build character, whatever that means. If we mean by that something like self-esteem, the evidence is crystal clear here. I like to say that competition is to self-esteem as sugar is to teeth. That's what the evidence shows. In any competitive encounter, losing is always possible, and that feels lousy. But even when you win, you gloat for a while. You soar. You're impossible to live with. But you come down. In fact, you crash down and you need more of it in order to get that same feeling. It's precisely like building up a tolerance to a drug. Or if I can switch metaphors, it's like drinking salt water when you're thirsty. The solution is the problem. The emotional needs that we attempt to meet through competition are exacerbated by competition. They make us more dependent. They make our self-esteem more contingent. I am good so far as I beat these people in these activities. There is no winning there. It is not the way to solve those emotional problems. Winning doesn't do it, and losing doesn't do it. Competition only makes more of itself. And there's lots of evidence suggesting that cooperative people are not people lost in some amorphous pond, some blob of a group. In fact, people who are distinguished by their cooperativeness also tend to have more of an internal sense that they can control events. That may seem surprising. But the converse should not seem surprising. Competition does not promote strong, good individualism, in the best sense of that word. It promotes dependency, because competition requires other people. It requires that my self-evaluation is dependent on other people. I need you to beat, and I need you to watch me beat him. That has nothing to do with a strong sense of self, despite the prejudice of lumping together individualism and competition. The third thing that competition does is it poisons our relationships with other people. We are envious of winners, which is not a pleasant emotion. We are contemptuous of losers. If you think about it, there's no nastier epithet in the American lexicon than loser. And we're suspicious of just about everyone. Hostile toward them, because even if you're not my rival today, you could be tomorrow. So I'm going to hold you at a distance from myself. I'm going to hold a part of myself in reserve. Why should I trust you if you're my competitor? It's irrational. And all the empirical evidence suggests just what you would expect. People who compete, or people in competitive situations, communicate less effectively, are less trusting, are less sensitive to other people's needs, and less able to take their point of view, to do perspective taking. Kids who are cooperative, or adults who are cooperative, find that those skills are all increased in amazing ways. People sometimes ask, does competition cause aggression? Competition is aggression. The only question is whether it will occasionally manifest itself in outright violence. It is an againsting process. We are at loggerheads. We are working at cross purposes. And we do it in sports, and we do it in the classroom. Those spelling bees and competitive grading systems. Long after kids forget how to spell some long word, or forget who the 12th president of the United States was, or any of the binomial equations, what they remember is the fundamental lesson of any competitive classroom, which is other people are potential obstacles to my success. That's what we teach in competition. And no kind of competition, not even the parent who says, okay, who can get into their pajamas fastest? No competition, not even a nice game of underhand softball, which is more underhanded than we might suspect. No competition at work. Friendliest employee, let alone for bonuses. None of this is innocuous. It all strengthens and reinforces and fortifies this message that sets us against one another. The question is not, do we need some competition? The question is, which kind is worse than the other? And that's why I'm suggesting that we have to work not merely to change our individual selves, not merely to go to psychotherapy and look deep within to find why I'm being competitive. I'll tell you why you're being competitive, because you live in a society that demands it of you every day of your lives. And until we make structural changes, it is self-deluding to talk about the prospect of merely working from within out. That's good too. I heartily recommend to you that you stop yourself and say, why did I interrupt him again? Why do I see this need to prove how clever I am? Why don't I just sit and listen and maybe learn something? That's great stuff. But it's not going to get very far until we change our recreation and our education and our workplaces and our families so that competition is no longer required. That's a harder task. And we Americans are very suspicious of any kind of structural change. We love to blame individuals. You're poor? You're just lazy. Get a job. You committed a crime? You're evil. Put you in jail for the rest of your lives. Kids aren't learning in school? Teachers aren't any good. You need more homework, etc. This lets us off the hook very easily, instead of looking at the deeper social and economic causes of these kinds of attitudes and these kind of behaviors. And that's what we have to change. And I'm afraid I have to take issue as well with my colleague Sam Keen in terms of changing the competition between the Soviet Union and the U.S. so we start competing about good stuff, like who can feed kids most. The answer to competition is not more competition. Any kind of competition, even in something that appears to be relatively salutary, something felicitous, something whose goal we all agree on, is going to fortify those underpinning structures that say we have to see who can be number one. The genuine alternative to being number one is not being number two. It's being able to dispense with these self-defeating rankings altogether. Let's see. Aren't some situations inherently, unavoidably, I guess that's supposed to be competitive, such as a shortage of jobs for professors, etc.? How can we structure things so that people in selective careers are not locked in a destructive competitive motivational structure? That's a very important question. Unfortunately, we're out of time. No? There is no easy answer to this. You know, the first thing to be said is that the arrangement we have that looks like a pyramid, specifically in corporations, and to some extent in terms of our universities too, I mean, God did not decree that organizations have to be shaped like pyramids. The idea that in order to do well, one must get up into a scarce position. The number of people available to do these tasks and the number of tasks are socially constructed decisions. I live in Boston where the parking is even worse than here. You know, there's one space, there's two cars, you look at it and you say, there's no choice but to compete. Well, yes, if you freeze the frame and only look at that. But you ask, you know, who decided the number of parking spaces? Who decided the quality of mass transit? Who made all of these decisions that led to that situation in which you have two people competing for the same job or two cars competing for the same space and so on? I don't have a recipe, and this goes for business and economic concerns either. I don't know how we can, in four easy lessons, transform our economic system into one that's cooperative and productive and democratic. I don't know the answer. I'm not satisfied with my own response any more than you probably are. But I know that we haven't even begun to ask those questions. The service I perform, if indeed it is a service, is the very modest one of saying, let's sweep out the myths that have been keeping us from asking those questions, and that goes for the structure in the universities as well.
Alfie Cohn. That's a talk from apparently 1989, maybe early 1990. Reagan years. Which, come to think of it, seem pretty similar to Obama years, don't they? Near the end, Cohn makes a key point. The problem is structural. Changing people's thoughts and feelings about competition is a worthy goal, but it's not enough in itself. Maybe not even doable in itself. We've got to change the institutions and social structures that produce and demand competition. Cohn might have said, more forcefully than he does, that institutions and structures serve the interests of established power. To remove this destructive competition, and to improve our lives in many other ways, we've got to confront established power. That's not competition, that's conflict. Cohn thinks that, unlike competition, conflict is inevitable, and sometimes good. Martin Luther King was right to oppose institutional racism. Unlike conflict, eliminating competition is doable and desirable. Let's just keep in mind that established power is going to resist, strongly, any attempts we make to change those institutions that serve the interests of the powerful. Worth trying to do, yes, but don't expect a cakewalk. We heard the majority of Cohn's talk today, and a little of the Q&A. If you want the whole shebang, you'll find a link on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And thanks to Xenophrenia for finding and making available said shebang. Illegitimi non carborundum. Last one to give up competition's a rotten apple. And ciao.